Chapter 2. You'll notice at the beginning of the chapter there's a list of phrases that are written in italics, and that gives you an idea of what's going to happen in the chapter. So it's always good to read those because it tells you, you know, what you can expect in the chapter. So I'm going to read that first. It says, the two strangers, the circus company, departure from Saratoga, ventriloquism, and legerdemain, journey to New York, free papers, Brown and Hamilton, the haste to reach the circus, arrival in Washington, funeral of Harrison, the sudden sickness, the torment of thirst, the receding light, insensibility, chains and darkness. Looks like it's going to be a pretty packed chapter. Okay, here we go. One morning, towards the latter part of the month of March, 1841, having at that time no particular business to engage my attention, I was walking about the village of Saratoga Springs, thinking to myself where I might obtain some present employment until the busy season should arrive. Anne, as was her usual custom, had gone over to Sandy Hill, a distance of some 20 miles, to take charge of the culinary department at Sherrill's Coffee House during the session of the court. Elizabeth, I think, had accompanied her. Margaret and Alonzo were with their aunt at Saratoga. On the corner of Congress Street and Broadway, near the tavern then, and for aught I know to the contrary, still kept by Mr. Moon, I was met by two gentlemen of respectable appearance, both of whom were entirely unknown to me. I have the impression that they were introduced to me by some one of my acquaintances, but who I have in vain endeavored to recall with the remark that I was an expert player on the violin. So he doesn't have work right now. He's looking for work, and he goes to town to sort of look for some work to keep him busy for now, and he's introduced by these two men, and now we're going to meet these two men. At any rate, they immediately entered into conversation on that subject, making numerous inquiries touching my proficiency in that respect. They're asking whether he's a good violin player, which we know from the previous chapter that he really is. My responses being to all appearances satisfactory, they proposed to engage my services for a short period, stating at the same time I was just such a person as their business required. Their names, as they afterwards gave to me, were Merrill Brown and Abram Hamilton, though whether those were their true appellations, I have strong reasons to doubt. So he meets these two guys. They say, we want to hire you to play violin, and their names are Merrill Brown and Abram Hamilton, but he kind of doubts whether those are their real names. The former, now he's talking about Merrill Brown, the former was a man apparently 40 years of age, somewhat short and thick-set, with a countenance indicating shrewdness and intelligence. He wore a black frock coat and a black hat, and said he resided either at Rochester or at Syracuse. The latter, so now he's talking about Hamilton, the latter was a young man of fair complexion and light eyes, and, I should judge, had not passed the age of 25. He was tall and slender, dressed in a snuff-colored coat, with glossy hat and vest of elegant pattern. His whole apparel was in the extreme of fashion. His appearance was somewhat effeminate, but prepossessing, and there was about him an easy air that showed he had mingled with the world. So he's just describing these two men. The second one is sort of a notable description because he says he was pretty effeminate and he was wearing really fashionable clothes, and that was sort of unusual at the time. They were connected, as they informed me, with a circus company, then in the city of Washington, that they were on their way thither to rejoin it, having left it for a short time to make an excursion northward for the purpose of seeing the country, and were paying their expenses by an occasional exhibition. They also remarked that they had found much difficulty in procuring music for their entertainments, and that if I would accompany them as far as New York, they would give me $1 for each day's services, and $3 in addition for every night I played at their performances, besides sufficient to pay the expenses of my return from New York to Saratoga. So they offer him, come with us to New York. we will pay you $1 a day. Plus, at night, sometimes we're going to do some sort of exhibits, or we're going to do a short show. And if you will play violin during the short shows, we will give you $3 for each of those. Plus, we'll pay for the expenses for you to come to New York and to return to Saratoga. So it sounds like a pretty good deal. I at once accepted the tempting offer, both for the reward it promised and from a desire to visit the metropolis. They were anxious to leave immediately. Thinking my absence would be brief, I did not deem it necessary to write to Anne whither I had gone. In fact, supposing that my return perhaps would be as soon as hers. So taking a change of linen and my violin, I was ready to depart. So he doesn't write to his wife. He doesn't, obviously he can't call, but he doesn't leave a note or anything saying where he is. He just goes because he thinks, oh, I'll just be gone a couple days and Anne will be gone a few days too. I might even beat her back to Saratoga. The carriage was brought round, a covered one, drawn by a pair of noble bays, altogether forming an elegant establishment. Their baggage, consisting of three large trunks, was fastened on the rack, and mounting to the driver's seat, while they took their places in the rear, I drove away from Saratoga on the road to Albany, elated with my new position, and happy as I had ever been on any day in all my life. So he leaves, he's psyched, he says, I'm going to get paid, here we go. And it's exciting, he's going to get to see New York, which he wants. We passed through Ballston, and striking the Ridge Road, as it is called, if my memory correctly serves me, followed it directly to Albany. We reached that city before dark, and stopped at a hotel southward from the museum. I turn the page, sorry. This night I had an opportunity of witnessing one of their performances, the only one during the whole period I was with them. Hamilton was stationed at the door. I formed the orchestra, while Brown provided the entertainment. It consisted in throwing balls, dancing on the rope, frying pancakes in a hat, causing invisible pigs to squeal, and other like feats of ventriloquism and legerdemain. The audience was extraordinarily sparse, and not of the selectest character at all, and Hamilton's report of the proceeds presented but a beggarly account of empty boxes. So they performed, but the crowd wasn't that great, they weren't too high class, there weren't that many people, and it sounds kind of like a lame show, really. Okay. Early next morning, we renewed our journey. The burden of their conversation now was the expression of an anxiety to reach the circus without delay. They hurried forward, without again stopping to exhibit, and in due course of time we reached New York. Taking lodgings at a house on the west side of the city, in a street running from Broadway to the river. I supposed my journey was at an end, and expected in a day or two, at least, to return to my friends and family at Saratoga. Brown and Hamilton, however, began to importune me to continue with them to Washington. They alleged that immediately on their arrival, now that the summer season was approaching, the circus would set out for the north. They promised me a situation and high wages if I would accompany them. Largely did they expatiate on the advantages that would result to me, and such were the flattering representations they made that I finally concluded to accept the offer. So they get to New York, and Hamilton and Brown say, wait, you've got to come with us to Washington, D.C. That's where the circus is, and we're going to leave from D.C., and we're going to go north to New York, so you're going to get to go back to your family, and you're so talented, we really need you. And so he agrees. The next morning, they suggested that, inasmuch as we were about entering a slave state, it would be well, before leaving New York, to procure free papers. So they're leaving New York, which is a free state, and they're heading south, and they're going into some slave states. So they say, you know, you should really get these free papers, papers that say that you're a free man. You should get those before we go, so that everybody will know, even in the slave state, that you're a free man. The idea struck me as a prudent one, though I think it would scarcely have occurred to me had they not proposed it. We proceeded at once to what I understood to be the custom house. They made oath to certain facts showing that I was a free man. So I'm going to skip a little bit ahead because basically he just gets these papers that say this is a free man. I'm going to skip to the next side of the page. It's page 15, to the first full paragraph that begins with the evidence. He's talking about having the papers now. With the evidence of freedom in my possession, the next day after our arrival in New York, we crossed the ferry to Jersey City and took the road to Philadelphia. Here we remained one night, continuing our journey towards Baltimore early in the morning. In due time, we arrived in the latter city and stopped at a hotel near the railroad depot, either kept by a Mr. Rathbone or known as Rathbone House. All the way from New York, their anxiety to reach the circus seemed to grow more and more intense. We left the carriage at Baltimore and, entering the cars, proceeded to Washington, at which place we arrived just at nightfall, the evening previous to the funeral of General Harrison, and stopped at Gadsby's Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue. Okay, so they leave from New York, he has the papers, they stop one night in Philadelphia, they go to Baltimore, they get in train cars or automobiles and go to Washington, D.C. And it's the night before President Harrison's funeral. We'll go from there. After supper, they called me to their apartments and paid me $43, a sum greater than my wages amounted to, which act of generosity was in consequence, they said, of their not having exhibited as often as they had given me to anticipate during our trip from Saratoga. They moreover informed me that it had been the intention of the circus company to leave Washington the next morning, but that on account of the funeral, they had concluded to remain another day. They were then, as they had been from the time of our first meeting, extremely kind. No opportunity was omitted of addressing me in the language of approbation, while, on the other hand, I was certainly much prepossessed in their favor. I gave them my confidence without reserve, and would freely have trusted them to almost any extent. Their constant conversation and manners toward me, their foresight in suggesting the idea of free papers, and 100 other little acts, unnecessary to be repeated, all indicated that they were friends indeed, sincerely solicitous for my welfare. I know not but they were innocent of the great wickedness of which I now believe them guilty. So he's saying, they paid him $43, which was more than they owed him, because they said, oh, we didn't, you know, you didn't get to play as often as we said you would, so here's some money. And he's saying they were incredibly kind. They were really nice. They were just lovely, and he felt, you know, that he could trust them. And he's giving us a little bit of foreshadowing here. He says, I know not but they were innocent of the great wickedness of which I now believe them guilty. So he says, now, in retrospect, looking back, I can see that they were bad guys. They were, and a great wickedness is coming. And we're going to learn about that. Whether they were accessories to my misfortunes, subtle and inhuman monsters in the shape of men, designedly luring me away from home and family and liberty for the sake of gold, those who read these pages will have the same means of determining as myself. If they were innocent, my sudden disappearance must have been unaccountable indeed. But revolving in my mind all the attending circumstances, I never could yet indulge towards them so charitable a supposition. So he says, I think they were guilty. But if they weren't, oh, you know, good for them. But I don't think so. I think they were guilty. And he's going to tell us by the end of this chapter what they were guilty of. And I think we know, in anticipating the title, 12 Years a Slave, and knowing he was born a free man, I think we have an idea of what they were guilty of. After receiving the money from them, of which they appeared to have an abundance, they advised me not to go into the streets that night, inasmuch as I was unacquainted with the customs of the city. Promising to remember their advice, I left them together, and soon after was shown by a colored servant to a sleeping room in the back part of the hotel on the ground floor. I laid down to rest, thinking of home and wife and children and the long distance that stretched between us, until I fell asleep. But no good angel of pity came to my bedside bidding me to fly. No voice of mercy forewarned me in my dreams of the trials that were just at hand. So they say, you shouldn't go out tonight. It's you don't know Washington, D.C. It could be dangerous for you. You should stay in the hotel. So he does, but he says he wished that he had some warning that these were bad guys, and nothing came to warn him. We're going to pause there and restart in the next video clip. See you in a minute.